The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
So, hello. I'm So Shin, and I'm just really happy to be with you and be sitting with you. Before we started sitting, I went outside. I live in Western Massachusetts, and you know, just took a little walk. And we've got daffodils, magnolia, forsythia. It's an exciting time. There's a lot of buds coming out, and I'm imagining those of you that are in New York. Actually, it's usually further along spring, so you may have other things blooming and grasses growing, and I just hope you're enjoying it. So because this has started to happen, I've been able to be outside in my garden a little bit now and started digging around and moving some rocks, and I think because of that, I remembered a story that I had heard a long time ago, and it's about a farmer. So it goes like this. Once there was an old farmer, and every day the farmer used his horse to work in his fields. One day, however, his horse ran away. All the villagers came by and they said, "You know, we're so sorry to hear about your horse. This is such bad luck." And the farmer said, "Bad luck, good luck. Who knows?" Well, a little while later, while the farmer was working outside, he looked up and he saw that his horse had returned. But the horse wasn't alone. There were a whole herd of horses, wild horses, had come back with him. So now the farmer had 10 horses instead of just his original one. Well, all the villagers came by to congratulate him. "Wow, you know, this is such good luck." But the farmer responded, "Bad luck, good luck, who knows?" Well, later, the farmer's son came by to help the father work in the field and train the new horses. And while he was trying to tame one of the horses, he fell off and he broke his leg. The villagers came by again to commiserate, "How awful, this is such bad luck." And the farmer responded, "Bad luck, good luck, who knows?" Well, while the farmer's son was still recovering, he wasn't able to walk or to do any manual labor. And at that time, a regiment from the army came by to recruit all the healthy young men. And when they stopped by the house and they saw the son was, you know, still in his cast, they passed him by. They didn't take him. Villagers came by again and said, "This is so wonderful. You are so lucky. You're really fortunate." The farmer replied, "Bad luck, good luck, who knows?" So I think this was actually originally a Taoist story, and it is told, I heard it in a Zen context. And actually, I guess it's had a wider audience now. I learned when I was looking this up that it's told by consultants in workshops and training groups, I guess to help participants feel less stressed and point out that there's, you know, another model for how we can be. The story is actually helpful in many ways. It points out some key Buddhist teachings. So the first one is, you know, change, impermanence. That's the nature of reality. The farmer understood that his circumstances were always changing, and so he didn't suffer when they did. Villagers, on the other hand, experience these swings of emotions for each iteration of the farmer's life. Not knowing. The farmer knows that he doesn't know how things are going to turn out, so he doesn't get caught up in opinions each moment while things are changing. The villagers, on the other hand, have their own opinions about each event that happens, and that in turn increases their emotional response. Non-discrimination, right? Not good, not bad. not getting caught up in right and wrong. These are just labels that we give to things based on our opinions and our likes and our dislikes, but they don't have any basis in reality. Because the farmer resided in not knowing, he doesn't experience strong likes and his dislikes. And that non-attachment allowed him to accept his circumstances without judgment. So the end result of all of this is equanimity. The farmer accepted the reality of impermanence, and he transformed it through the practice of not knowing and bearing witness. So it's convincing, I think. We know that this has a lot of truth, right? So we can see right now how events that are truly tragic can sometimes have beneficial results. So, for example, even our being here tonight that comes out of the pandemic and the whole country locking down and people getting sick and some people dying and people losing their jobs, you know, we're together. I'm here in Massachusetts and you're in New York and myriad other places. And, you know, even the horrible, horrible story of George Floyd, you know, out of that really terrible criminal action came a whole movement and a whole awakening of consciousness and a real desire to make change happen. And it's also true that events that we consider beneficial can have unintended consequences. So even right now, although we don't know how it's all going to turn out, you know, many of us are just anxiously waiting for the vaccine, but this is another strengthening of the pharmaceutical industry and a greater control that they have over our lives, right? That might not turn out as well as we think it will. Or something like Obama's election, you know, that was so beautiful when it happened, and now the backlash afterwards that we're all dealing with. So, you know, we have to admit, you know, that we don't know how things are going to turn out, and things are always changing. And if we can understand that, it can help decompress at least some of the stress and maybe actually lead to some real ease as we move through it. But it's interesting that as I was turning this story over in my mind, I actually found myself getting annoyed with the farmer. So first of all, I find him passive. He doesn't seem like he's actively participating in his life. We have the sense that he has a practice that involves deep concentration, and this has given him tranquility. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's given him much insight into himself or his relationship with the world. He's relying on not knowing, but by doing that, he's not taking responsibility. You know, he accepted 9 horses. Is that greed? Could he have shared them with some of the other villagers? His neighbors, you know, just had their grown men taken away. Could he have done anything to help? You know, I was thought of, you know, the 7 samurai. Maybe he could have sabotaged a bridge or something. So he's staying in non-discrimination where there's no good or bad, but he's not actually taking action. And the story seems to suggest that we actually like achieve the fruits of practice from all our work when we can transcend suffering and arrive at this place of peace and tranquility. And at the same time, when I think about the villagers, they seem to me really just open, engaged, generous. They don't seem to be suffering from envy and judgment. They're emotional, but they're not hysterical. So the story actually serves to reinforce some ideas that I know I came into practice with. What enlightenment is supposed to look or sound like? There's some goal that we're supposed to attain. So what started out as a kind of inspirational story for me started to seem more problematic. So let's look at this through a different lens. And I'd like to bring in a couple of images. And these come from Chinese and Japanese ink brush painting. And I'm not an expert in this at all, but I did study it a little bit. And I learned that there's a couple of themes or images that are very often used in paintings, and they're symbolic, and they often symbolize, you know, the human spirit. And so the first one I want to look at is the bamboo. So the bamboo is very frequently used in these paintings to symbolize the human being. Why? Well, it's resilient. You know, it can bend all the way over, but it doesn't break. Can withstand the forces of wind and rain, earthquakes. It's connected to all the other bamboos through a shared network, roots. So it can be represented as a unique image of one, but actually we know whenever there's one bamboo, there's another bamboo. They're not alone. And most importantly, I think it's a real bodhisattva plant. It has more uses than just about any other plant in Asia, I think. It can be housing materials, rafts, gourds, clothing, poles, flutes, food, you name it. And the reason why it can be all these things is because it's empty. It's hollow on the inside. It's such a beautiful image of, you know, us. We're empty. We're not some fixed thing that, you know, is always has to behave a certain way, always has to react a certain way. It's at the mercy of the elements. We're empty. The other image that's frequently used is that of a flowering tree or branch, very often a plum or a cherry. So our own white plum sangha is named after the white flower of the flowering plum tree. This has a very different quality. First and foremost, I think it's ephemeral, you know. Flowers blossom, but they don't last for very long. They eventually fall off and they die. They have their moment of splendor and then it passes. The trees and branches aren't necessarily resilient. You know, they can break, they can be hit by lightning, they can be buffed about by the winds and the rains. But when they break, the tree is still good. You know, they don't have to hide or cover up their brokenness. And in fact, you know, in Japan, where they're very aesthetically tuned into this, very often they'll support a broken branch or even a whole broken tree so that it can still continue to grow and reveal itself through that brokenness. And it thrives, even in very adverse circumstances. And these branches and trees are bodhisattva plants too, just in different ways. They give shade, beauty, wood, fruit, wine, food. And so they can be all of these things because they're solid and they have sap, life force running through them, wood. So in both those cases, there are examples of different kinds of bodhisattvaness, for lack of a better word. We need actually not to choose one or the other. We just need to know and have the wisdom to know when to use one aspect or the other. What happens, though, when we get stuck on what one idea of wisdom is supposed to be, what it's supposed to look like, or when we get stuck on just one image of what Zen is supposed to look like? And I actually have an example of this latter from our very own retreats at Garrison Institute. So if you've been there, you know that Garrison has this beautiful walled garden made of stone. It's very old building that used to be, I think, maybe a monastery, and has that quality to it. And it has several enormous bamboo plantings. Really, I've never seen anything like it because I haven't traveled to anywhere in Asia. And so it's just these gorgeous groves. The bamboos are, you know, I think at least as high as two people or at least two of me. And, you know, they're just very still and very compelling. So, you know, in China and Japan, bamboo is part of the ecosystem, and it has an extensive network of life systems that, you know, live off of it, eat off of it, hide in it, whatnot. And it's abundant. But in North America, what I noticed is there doesn't appear to be an ecosystem. You know, it's always dead silent. I've never seen an insect or a bug or any kind of bird in there that just doesn't attract North American species because it's not from here. And worse than that, because that might be fine, you know, just in a limited circumstance, but it is not abundant, actually. It's invasive. And so if you leave this beautiful walled compound and you go further into the woods that are around the facility, you'll see the bamboo spreading everywhere. And it's going to choke off the maples and the pines and the native species. And it's, you know, I have to say, not good. You know, it needs to be cleaned up. It's going to ruin things. Now, it's true that we don't really know what's going to happen, right? And if we take a very long view, it's entirely possible that one day the climate's going to have changed here in North America and bamboo will be, you know, exactly what the continent needs, and the birds and the other species will have adapted, and, you know, bamboo's the way to go. But that's not the case right now. You know, right now, the bamboo needs to be cleaned up. So there's a koan that I want to bring into this that kind of rounds out a little what I'm talking about here. And that is from the Book of Serenity, case 70. It's called Jinshan Asks About Nature. Master Jinshan asked Master Yushan, clearly knowing the unborn nature of life, why are we stayed by life? Zhuxian said, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, can you make them serve their purpose? Yinshan said, later on, you'll be enlightened on your own. Zhuxian said, I am just this way. What is your meaning? Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That is the cook's quarters. Zhuxian then bowed. So, you know, this is a story about two masters. Neither one of them is an unnamed monk. So we know that, you know, what they both have to say has some wisdom. And so Jinshan is asking a question. We realize emptiness, but what do you do about the fact that we still have feelings and reactions, or that we encounter obstacles and setbacks, or that even that we die and pass away? And so, unlike the farmer who doesn't seem to embrace the enormity of the gift of being alive, who doesn't ask, Jinshan's asking the question. And Yushan says, you know, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, can you make them serve the purpose? So bamboo shoots are young bamboo. They're immature. They're perhaps in the early stages of practice. They're weak. Bamboo, you know, mature bamboo, is possible, maybe at a more advanced stage of practice where you've built up some strength and then you can make rope. So what he's saying is it takes time, right? you don't get, you know, everything you're supposed to get from practice all at once. You need to keep doing it. You need to practice and you need to build up your strength. Right now, the green bamboo does not have the strength to serve its purpose, and so it'll be stayed by life. Well, Jinshan isn't fully convinced. He's asking him to look deeper, and he's goading him a little bit. What do you mean later on? What about now? He's asking him to look at his assumptions. What does it mean to be enlightened? Is enlightenment something you get to gradually, suddenly, or that you already have? Is he stuck in his initial understanding of emptiness? He's saying realization of emptiness is not later on, because there's only now. There is no later on. Emptiness takes a lifetime to know because our life takes a lifetime to know. So we can only serve the purpose of our life in this moment in which it is lived. What is the purpose of a bamboo? A bamboo shoot makes soup. A mature bamboo makes rope. Well, Jishan doesn't quite get it. And he says, well, I'm just this way. What is your meaning? And I happen to like that expression because, you know, he doesn't understand. He thinks maybe it's just something about who he is, but, you know, he's willing to ask. And it acknowledges, actually, that each of us is different. We don't have exactly the same realization, and we don't manifest our realization in the same way. I am just this way, and you are just that way. And then Jishan says, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That is the cook's quarters. So we could also say, this is the horse that ran away. That is my son with the broken leg. Or look, the squash is blooming. This year, there's going to be a big crop. And we shun bowed because we don't know. We seek to discover so that we can respond. So I've been comparing two different qualities, kind of naming them as the farmer versus the villagers, and the bamboo versus the flowering plant. We could say the unborn nature of things or the absolute versus being stayed by life, the relative. And it's helpful to break it down, and that's what these stories do, so we can look at it and see how these different parts function in us. But the reality is life doesn't break down into parts. And this, none of these things exist as separate entities. They exist in us as a whole. The farmer is himself a villager, and the villagers probably have farms, so they are one community. Bamboo and plum look very different and have different functions and uses, but in Asia, they're all part of the same ecosystem. And Jishan and Jishan are both masters in the same lineage. Sometimes they're going to agree. Sometimes they're going to see things differently. Sometimes they're going to teach others. Sometimes they're going to learn from each other. And all the while, they're both deepening their wisdom and learning. But I do think that there's a caution to be learned from these stories. And that is that a couple things, you know, we can begin to think that the main focus of our practice is to kind of develop concentration and achieve a certain state of calmness or samadhi. And we can end up avoiding a deeper inquiry into our life. And we could end up developing a detachment where we're not fully engaged with the world. And this idea that enlightenment is something that we arrive at gradually, instead of realizing it throughout our practice right now, that can be an obstacle for us. Our practice is not confined to a state that we achieve on the cushion. Our practice, I think, means that we can say, who knows, to the many complicated, joyful, and difficult circumstances we find ourselves in. And we could recognize in the realm of the absolute that there is no good or bad fortune. But it also means that sometimes we're really sad when things don't work out, or really happy when things do. Then we can say, that's so unfortunate, or that's amazing. So I'm going to end with a poem that's by Ryokan. Autumn bush clovers, eulalias, violets, dandelions, silk tree blossoms, plantains, morning glories, bonnets, asters, daylily flowers, and daylilies, which I planted in my garden as I nurtured them with care, watering and shading them morning to night. People loved them, and so did I. Then a strong storm happened to rage on the evening of the 25th day of the fifth month. My plants were hit by the rain, crushed into a hundred and thousands of pieces. I felt so sad, but I had no one to blame. 100 grasses I planted at my hut depend upon the will of the wind.